Amidst the velvety cloak of the night sky, UFOs emerge like silent specters, dancing on the edge of human comprehension, their origins and intentions veiled in cosmic ambiguity. Flying saucers traverse the celestial canvas with a grace that defies earthly laws, leaving behind whispers of wonder and whispers of trepidation. In the grand tapestry of the cosmos, UFOs remain as elusive as the secrets of the universe itself, beckoning us to gaze skyward and ponder the mysteries that linger beyond the reach of human understanding. Welcome to Paranormal Patio, the podcast that brings you one step closer to the paranormal and occult, one patio at a time. Joining us on this paranormal journey are our intrepid guides, Jason and Keith. Pull up a chair. In this hair-raising episode, we'll be shedding light on not one, but two compelling UFO incidents that left witnesses bewildered and ignited the flames of curiosity and conspiracy. First, we'll journey to the heartland of America, where a quiet rural patch of fields and farmland in Indiana was thrust into the spotlight, and the night sky became a backdrop for strange lights. Yes, you guessed it. We're talking about Lucky Point, Indiana. But that's not all. We'll also venture into the chilling account of Captain Thomas Mantell, an experienced pilot who met a puzzling fate while pursuing a UFO over Kentucky skies, an event known as the Mantell UFO Incident. These stories are not just about lights in the sky. They're about the unexplained, the otherworldly, and the inexplicable encounters that challenge our understanding of reality. So, fasten your seatbelts, dear listeners, and prepare for a journey that will take you beyond the stars and into the realms of the unknown. Let's lift the curtain on UFOs and discover what lies beneath.
Welcome to Paranormal Patio. I'm Jason, as always.
And I'm Keith. I'm back this week, sick for the last couple, so.
You might be wondering why we're wearing these aluminum foil helmets.
It kind of gives me, but yeah, it happens.
You know, it's a decision we decided to make because tonight, the topic, transdimensional vessels, Keith.
The one I don't believe, but you can go back. Go forward.
That's true. But it's going to be a great episode. Keith is going to talk about one of our local UFO hotspots over by Vincennes, Indiana. And this, I gotta separate this. I can't.
Like the lumberjack cat.
Oh, geez. Yeah, it was too much. I felt like I was talking inside of a coffee can. So, Keith is going to talk about Lucky Point, which is, it's, I think, northwest of Vincennes. It's like between Vincennes and Wheatland.
Yep.
And the old...
It should be southwest. Right?
Northeast.
Northeast, yeah.
Well, it's one of the directions.
It's one of the out there.
But one of the old MUFON state reps... was really closely involved with Lucky Point.
Yep.
He did a great interview on another podcast, which, if I remember, I'll put a link to in the show notes. This was a long time ago. I think it was called like Eerie X or Eerie Radio or something along those lines.
Yeah, I think it was one of them shows. They used to have an app at all the shows. Like,
yeah.
You used to have to listen like
yeah.
that, not get on YouTube or Spotify.
Right.
And they had like an app, had like 10 different shows, and you could get the coast-to-coast old episodes, that's what I used
sure,
for.
Sure. Anyway, the Jerry Sievers was his name. He was the Indiana State Rep. He passed away, gosh, I want to say like 5 or 6 years ago. It was pre-pandemic, I think, that he passed away. So, and we're coming up on 4 years since that mess started. So, anywho.
Yeah, this is a long one, too.
This is it's one of my favorite stories. I think I included a transcript of most of what was said in his interview. on that podcast. And unfortunately, he had a website that the Indiana MUFON used to like keep up, and they don't do that anymore.
Yeah, it's old. I went to it a couple
times. Yeah, none of the links work.
You know, it redirects you to everything. Mm-hmm.
And none of his work exists online. But it's a really... He was a really good dude and a really good researcher, and he had some wild stories from out there. Most of it kind of happened back in the 70s, but even still into modern time, things were going on. And that's an easy one for us to go make a trip to some night when it's warmer. I would definitely, if we have cell service out there, we could do a live stream from Lucky Point.
I go out that way all the time going to work, and we go through that whole area.
Yeah. Check the cell reception next time you're out that way.
Okay, because we go to the back way. When we're coming back from Jasper, we always come to the back way to Vincent's, cross back.
Yeah. So you might be able to see kind of...
Where's that?
Yeah. If it's decent, we can do a low-quality live stream. When we went out to the unnamed cemetery out there down that way that I don't want to say the name of with the balls of light and the and the she ape and all of that. You and I went in August. We did not do a live stream then, but I went later in January. This is like 2 years ago, but with my buddy Levi.
The night with the whistles?
Yes. Yeah. Weird. And we did a live stream on my phone from out there. So... That was really low quality signal, but it worked enough. So I think if we have at least, you know, like 2 bars, we can probably pull off a live stream at Lucky Point.
And that was the year it got really, really cold too, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was negative, that was the first
out there.
That was the first snow that year. Yeah, that and it was in January.
Out there, yeah.
Because I wanted to go because of the snow, because it would isolate the sounds more.
Yes.
That was the idea.
It's cushion. Yep.
God, this thing is hot. Right.
I took the beanie off, though, and from underneath that, so kind of...
Yeah, you're not grounded anymore.
Nope.
Anyway, so this is going to be one of my favorite episodes of the season, I think, just because of Lucky Point stuff. And the special guest interview is Nathan Isaac.
Okay.
He's going to be talking about a new project that he's working on called Hidden in the Herd, which is him uncovering the truth behind the cattle mutilations in the West.
My theory on cattle mutilations, they always take a reproductive organ.
Yeah.
They're using them as surrogate wounds.
Oh, I don't think so.
You don't think so? That's just...
Wait till you hear Hidden in the Herd. It's going to blow your mind.
Because that's what I think of it, because religions go back to the celestial bovine, and not more than one does.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where we come from. They bred us if we were created through in a simulation, but a natural simulation and created for mates. And
you're gonna lose your shit when you hear Hidden in the Herd. It'll be coming out after season 3 of Pennyroyal, which I'm sure Nathan will clear up later. But I got to hear about an hour-long presentation in Nashville at Strange Realities this year of Hidden in the Herd. And of course, I'm a member of Pennyroyal's Patreon group, the Liminal Lodge, so I've heard most of the information. But Nathan has been gracious enough to come on this episode, and he's going to do like a 30-minute abridged version.
Ooh.
Like a teaser, kind of. So it won't be as deep as what his actual podcast will be, which is deep. I mean, it's wild.
So I'll have to wait till the episode comes out before I...
I'm actually going to interview him at 10 o'clock tonight. So you can stay and be on it if you want to sit over here with me and look at the purple screen.
Maybe. We'll figure it out here at 10 o'clock.
Anyway, so this is Transdimensional Vessels. This is episode 4. Glad to have Keith back on the mend.
I'm glad to be back.
Oh, man. We don't say the C word. I'm going to bleep that.
Okay.
We don't say the C word.
We don't
give it any power.
Yeah.
It's rough.
That's why you don't say the other C word. The inspiring C word. The conspiracy.
Oh, that one.
We don't say that one either. My friend group, we had it for the longest time. We didn't say that stuff. And somebody would say, when you say it, they'd point out, hey, we don't say that.
On conspiracy?
Yeah.
Dude.
It's all conspiracy.
Hey, I'm going to pick a word that's fairly common, and I'm just going to start. We don't say that word.
Yep.
I'm going to do that from now on. Not on the show, but like in real life. I'm going to annoy everyone at work.
I don't say that.
We don't say that word.
You just stare at him. What's this guy's problem?
I love it. So, yeah, we're tinfoiled up. And Keith, why don't you tell us about Lucky Point, man?
Oh, Lucky Point.
Jerry Seaver.
Indiana side of the would be Wabash Valley.
Yep.
Started out with Lucky Point Transdimensional Vessels.
Yes, sir.
The first white settlers of the area named Lucky Point. They could always find a deer or other game in the wooded point of land, which jutted out into a swampy backwater slough of the White River in a semi-remote area of eastern Knox County, Indiana. Mm-hmm. The White River, it snakes.
Yes,
you
it does.
You go over twice, depending on what road you're on over there.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going this way to the east, and you cross it, and then you go to the south, cross it, too.
Yep.
And I'm pretty sure, what are the other ones? Rock River, but that's north.
I think that's further north.
These first settlers' contact with the Native American tribes who inhabited this area has kept alive Native oral legends concerning Lucky Point. Today, the point overlooks fields of corn and soybeans, which are crossed by high-tension electrical transmission lines, and is surrounded by several farm homes. But Lucky Point has been a remarkable place of strange occurrences and remains. I hear nothing but about people that are walking through the high tension wires. I've heard a lot of Bigfoot stories about that. The one I talked about when I was mushroom hunting, when I was out in the woods, that's where the one where I was getting the tree knocks. I was walking through an area like that, with all the power lines going through.
Yeah, it's weird, right?
Yep.
You know, I think it's the magnetism, because electromagnetism. It's just like a channel of EM.
Or it's just a hidden path, a roadway they use.
Yeah, that too, but you know, you have EMF that like will totally change the vibe of a room and make people think their house is on it when really they have like really bad wiring and stuff. And so I think that might be part of it. But there's some really cool stuff about these. I think it's in what you have in your hands. If it's not, I'll talk about it.
Okay.
About these high tension wires.
What follows sounds like fantasy, but according to the witness, their reports are true. Historical and physical research has built a solid foundation for these reports to rest upon. Local MUFON investigators and others have compiled literally hundreds of reports concerning paranormal phenomena. This includes reports of UFOs, spiritual ghosts, ghost lights, hauntings, electromagnetic anomalies, Bigfoot, telepathic messages sent and received, radar anomalies that included with UFO sightings, and some that do not. The list grows. And,
yeah.
And it has. There's new reports from Vincent every once in a while. I got on a few months ago. There was one from Route 50 going toward Vincent.
Yeah. And historically, even the dirigible air flap, the big flying like ships.
Yeah.
There was a sighting in Vincent's from them, you know. So years. Like
the beat, yeah, the,
yep. A long time ago.
There's they were on one of the episodes on, I can't remember what channel it was, but they went out there.
Oh really?
Yeah, the purgatory.
Oh yep.
And in 2014, Indianapolis Monthly published a story called The 10 Weirdest UFO Cases in Indiana. Included in the list are the sightings at Lucky Point. To provide a chronological timeline of Indiana UFO stories, I'll read this article now. Some of these sightings are very close to Lucky Point. And there it is, a mysterious airship.
Oh, perfect.
Yep. Mysterious airship sighting, Vincent's, 1897. So, hey.
Yeah.
Now I think of historical building the railroads at that point in time here.
Yeah, probably.
Building the world first refinery.
Yep.
In the Indian refinery.
Mm-hmm. Which is on the Illinois side, but.
Yes, which is on the Illinois side.
Still close.
Yeah.
What, 15 minutes? 20 minutes from Vincent's?
Starting in 1896, witnesses in California reported seeing a large, unidentified craft in the sky, and numerous sightings surfaced in other states as the objects made its way east across the country. That is, before the invention of the airplane and long before dirigibles. Newspapers hyped the progress of the airship, including the Vincent's Morning Commercial, which in 1897 printed the accounts of a number of reputable citizens who variously claimed to have seen something resembling a sphere or golden light, a ball of fire, and a flying steamboat. So, they've been seeing them here for years.
Oh, yeah.
Everywhere. stories up and down from here. Yeah, 50 long stocking now.
Dude, the audio is going to be terrible on this episode from all the crinkling.
It's all right. A huge metallic object, Terre Haute. French, all these French towns.
Oh, yeah.
We do come from New France originally, yep. So this is what we're here a long time.
Yeah, and we're like equidistant from Vincent's Zero. Like, it's negligible miles.
Yeah.
Like, pretty much right in the middle.
And if you're in shit like that, it's seconds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's like walking over a beach.
Yeah.
Grain of sand.
Yep.
Just 4 years after the oft-disputed UFO crash near Roswell, New Mexico, a teletype message arrived at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. Of course, it always does.
Every time.
I always talk about my grandpa, radar technician. He was there.
We got to dig into that someday.
We do. The stuff he used to say, I should have interviewed him before he passed.
Yeah.
Should have wrote it down just so I got all the stories right, being in Cheyenne and in the mountain and going around Canada and building the towers when they put in the defense system and they first put... Yeah.
Dude, if we have time tonight, let's record a bonus video for Patreon to talk about that.
Maybe. I'd get my brother together. I want to have it put together first.
Okay. We'll do it another time then.
Because, just the stuff right out of where they said they took it. And I was told this in the 90s. Well, 80s, late 80s is what my grandpa said. Now they took him to Wright Patterson, Ohio by train.
Yep.
And I was like, huh? And I was told this 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Told about the Cave of Gold. Finding the Cave of Gold. My grandpa was in the Air Force. So it's...
Patreon's going to get lit, folks. Make sure you get signed up. Patreon.com/BeyondThePatio.
Move back here. Addressed to a member of the USA Intelligence Brass. It related to Roy Messmore, Chief Aircraft Communicator at Terre Haute Holman Municipal Airport, had joined the ranks of those who now believe in flying saucers after he saw a huge metallic disc speeding across the field. Air Force Intelligence ordered an immediate investigation and discovered that a pilot flying over by nearby Paris, Illinois, had separately reported a similar sighting only 3 minutes later. An official report concluded that what the men saw may have been a jet aircraft observed when the reflection of the sun may have distorted the aircraft in the eyes of the observer.
Possible.
Flying low. In daytime, the had to have been. In his best-selling book, The Hynek UFO Report, J. Allen Hynek, astronomer and pioneer UFOologist known for introducing the Close Encounter Classification System, described the incident as one of the rare cases in which observers in separate localities saw the same UFO at almost the same time. Well, then we'll get years later here in Illinois when everybody's seen one.
Sure.
In UFO invasion of 1973, Delaware County. Delaware County.
I don't remember where that's at.
I don't either. On the night of October 9th, residents of East Central Indiana, so it's not too far actually, lit up first responder switchboards with upwards of 700 calls reporting UFO sightings. According to an article in the Cincinnati Post, local law enforcement officers spent hours tracking the object, described as a blinking red, white, blue, revolving light, and often hovering near the ground. Astronomy students at Ball State University claim to have seen the UFO by telescope, and radar operators at an airfield in Fort Wayne allegedly picked up an unexplained blip on the screen. In fact, a widespread fury of activity known as the Flap. That October came to be known as the UFO invasion of 1973, and Congressman Roush,
one of the two,
quoted in the Columbus Citizen Journal, worried that the increased sightings nationally could lead to a state of panic and hysteria, which ought to be the concern about it. What was that guy's name that just came out? That was
Roush.
Okay, so it's like, oh! Maybe they've been in there for a while.
Just finally came out. I don't think he's that old.
And he's not.
He'd be like 80.
Yeah. I've been telling him for years.
He's got really good genetics.
Yep. This is the intruders.
This is a good one.
The incredible visitations of Copley Woods. The visitations at Copley Woods, that's Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
As the story goes, Debbie Jordan Cowell, then a young woman living with her parents at their east side home, so east side, in Indianapolis, yep. So that's off 70, that area. Or that's over on the other side of over, Indianapolis, yeah. Never mind. Was abducted by alien beings and subjected to transgenic experimentation. Evidence of the visitations remained in the form of a bare spot in the yard, where it was said no vegetation would grow for years. Her accounts were documented in the best-selling book, The Intruders, The Incredible Visitations of Copley Woods, which identified Jordan Cobble as Kathy Davis and used a fictional place and name. So she kept the name hidden for years before she came out, finally.
Yep.
Because at that time, you couldn't.
No, you know, yeah.
You get hate mail on this when you actually sure. send a letter. You send a letter, you're a liar. By popular paranormal author Bud Hopkins, the story also inspired a television miniseries.
Yep. I need to track that down.
Yeah. Old media, though. It's got to be there somewhere.
Probably somewhere.
In Internet Archive or something.
Somewhere.
The Mongo photo. Oh, Mongo.
Mongo.
Related to Chongo. In northeastern Indiana, near the Michigan border. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's up. Been there many times. Six men were sitting around a campfire on the night of August 31st, when according to a Michigan Department of Natural Resource fire supervisor identified as only J.K., they saw something blowing through the treetops that moved right out from behind the trees into an open area near a road and hovered toward us, and it was clear as it can be. It was a flying saucer, just that vivid. One of the men managed to take a photograph of the object. Although a blimp was reported in the area that night, an investigator from the Indiana chapter of Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, an organization of volunteers who investigate accounts of extraterrestrial phenomena, looked into the report and determined this. Aerial object photograph cannot be positively identified at this time. It remains a UFO.
Yep.
When they're still using that UFO term. That's 90. So this is got start in 1800s and still going all the way up to yep. the 90s.
Yep.
So 100 years up so far.
Yep.
The more we progress, the more we start seeing them.
That's true.
And the more we destroy, the more we start seeing the Bigfoot. It's just
nature versus technology, you think?
Yeah. We are not animals, we're not machines, but what are we then?
It's a topic for another night.
Kokomo. The Kokomo boom, 2008. At approximately 10:30 p.m. on April 16, several loud percussive noises rattled at homes in Kokomo, and residents reported seeing streaks of light illuminate the sky. The events prompted local authorities to dispatch law enforcement to look for a possible downed aircraft, but no evidence of a crash were ever found. According to an Associated Press article printed the next day, an Indiana Air National Guard officer at Fort Wayne said the boom and accompanying lights could have been from an F-16 training exercise breaking the sound barrier.
Could have been.
And deploying flares. But added that its unit logs did not show any sonic booms were produced that night. In the transcript of the radio transmission from the evening, a sheriff's deputy says, Grisham Air Reserve Base near Kokomo just advised me their security forces advised there's not any military aircraft that's been up or doing anything in that area because they just contacted Fort Wayne as well to make sure. Some ufologists have disputed that F-16s were the source of the phenomenon, claiming on one website, for example, that monitoring revealed at least three anomalous radar-only tracks, which exhibited unusual flight characteristics in the Discovery Channel's Investigation X and History Channel's UFO Hunters highlighted this incident on national television.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, there's a few of them. They've been in this area a couple times.
Sure.
Okay, we got Matthew Reed abduction, Brownsburg, 2009. Here we go with the abductions. They're all around this area. On the night of March 30th, while driving home to Brownsburg, after seeing a movie in Avon, Matthew Reed reportedly saw an orange ball of light in the sky. Then about an hour and a half later, he found himself outside of his vehicle, which was parked on the side of the road. He later revealed that he'd been taken aboard a spacecraft and examined by extraterrestrial creatures. And that he and his brother were abducted on three separate occasions as boys living in Massachusetts. The case has been featured in docuseries on the Science Channel and Destination America. I'm feeling. No. And then no one talked about it. You couldn't tell nobody.
Right.
I've noticed they stop coming to you after you've gained consciousness. like once you hit that age where you actually gain consciousness, so you don't have those memories.
Mm.
I was hearing people, oh, I was 4 years old or I was 5 years old when it started, but then it stopped all of a sudden. Were they done with you? Or did you have memories now and they couldn't suppress it?
That's an interesting take.
Suppress it as easily.
I mean, that guy was, obviously he was driving, but.
Oh, yeah, he was driving his car and they let it steal people from the cars all the time.
Like, historically, there's a lot of adults, but yeah, childhood abductions, yeah, there's a lot. For sure.
Yes. Yeah, most of them are. I've listened to a lot of it. A lot of them are childhood abductions. The Family Secret Reveal, Logansport. That's not too far from here.
Nope.
Mufon, Indiana, only recently logged case number 32747, but it contained the oldest report in its files. On October 20th, a man submitted an old video recording of his great-grandmother and her sisters recounting the details of an alleged UFO encounter their father, a farmer, had experienced in Logansport area. Probably sometime in the 1890s. So this is the oldest one out of all of them.
So far.
And it started in 1896.
Yeah, or 97, something like that.
On the tape, the woman describes taking food to her father and grandfather in the field one day when they yelled at her to hide in the woods. They later told her they'd seen a flying machine fly over the field and that little people had gotten out of the craft, collected samples of corn and soil, then departed. The woman's father then made her promise never to talk about it. Goblins. They were here, too.
Yeah.
Did they fly, though? In the story.
Well, in the 1955 Kelly Hopkinsville,
yes.
There was, they saw a UFO earlier
before
in the evening before they encountered the beings. Mm-hmm. So they think that it might have crashed too. So.
And then they were just messing around.
Then they got into the cave system and they ended up in Evansville two or three nights, either before or after. I don't remember which. And then all the way over in eastern Kentucky, through the Mammoth Cave system. Yep. So.
God. Lucky Point. Here we go.
There we go.
Hoosier Hotspot. Monroe City.
Monroe City. That's it. Yeah.
Yes.
So that's like between Wheatland and Vincent's.
Yes, right there. You go 41 and.
Yeah, like you almost like make a triangle, like Wheatland to Vincent's and then come over.
Right there, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Right where the last gas station on 41 is before you get to Vincent's.
I think that's a road, yeah.
Yep. Okay. In southwest Indiana near Vincent's, a patch of land near a rural stretch of White River known as Lucky Point has been the site of unexplained phenomenon for decades. In 1896... The Vincent Sun commercial site is in MUFON. Assistant Director Jerry Sievers reported there had been nearly 100 UFO sightings in the past 10 to 15 years in Lucky Point.
Yep. It's a lot.
And that was in 1986.
Yes.
In one case, a farmer claimed to have been seen an orange ball of light hovering over his cattle pen. The next day, found a calf whose brain had been removed from a precise egg-shaped insertion. Like, scooped it right out of there clean. In another account, a sheriff's deputy had stopped in his car in an area and seen a large black triangle 100 feet on a side with beings looking out the craft windows. One evening in 2006, investigator Terry Teverball, who lives in the area, receives 10 calls in the span of half an hour from witnesses who, according to a statement, claim to have seen a dome disc, dark in color, with three large orange lights along the edge of the triangle. 2006, and he's over there investigating?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. He's had a number of 10 people are calling him, you know what I mean?
Sure. That's a third of the population.
Hey, buddy, I know you're into that stuff. I just seen one.
I think he was like a field investigator for MUFON,
okay.
And he was under Sievers.
And he... Relative to the area.
Yeah, yeah.
So he would be the one that gets the calls.
In Monroe City, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, from the Vincent Sun commercial, 1986. Locals learned Knox County has a UFO hotspot. So this is where they learn. After this, apparently, when this takes place, they publish it in the paper.
Yep.
A Knox County site has been a hotspot for UFO sightings during the last 12 years. According to Mutual UFO Network, Lucky Point, located about 12 miles southeast of Vincent's on the White River floodplain, has been the site of between 50 and hundreds of sightings during the past two decades, or UFOs or unidentified flying objects. A phrase coined by the government information officer in the late, in the early 1950s. Were the focal point of a MUFON held here Saturday after at the Knights of Columbus Hall. So they did a symposium.
Mm-hmm.
Skipped that on accident.
That's all right.
And they called UFOs Are Real.
Yep.
Which was attended by about 20 enthusiasts from as far away as Louisville, Kentucky. The symposium was held at part of MUFON's observance of the second annual National UFO Information Week, August 10th through 17th. Jerry L. Sivers, 140 Ramsey Road, is Assistant State Director of MUFON. Sivers talked about several of the Lucky Point phenomena, which included cattle mutilation, the sightings of huge hairy being, and the sighting by Knox County Sheriff's Department deputy of a large triangular UFO containing slender beings with large heads. The talls. That's mm-hmm. the ones I told everybody. That's the ones you don't have to walk.
Something really interesting about that story later on, too, that blew my mind when I heard it in the interview on that other podcast.
About this story right here?
Yeah, about the beings seen in the craft. It's awesome.
White River Peninsula, MUFON has reported nearly 100 sightings in the area alone in the last 10 to 15 years. Many of the other sightings have gone unreported because they are so similar to existing reports, or because the residents have grown accustomed to the oddities. No one listened. No one. You didn't see nothing.
Yep.
Don't talk about it. Seaver said many of the sightings are of nocturnal lights. Easy time to see them.
Yep.
Sun doesn't reflect. Light reflects off them. That's why you can't see them in the daytime.
Yep.
Nocturnal lights moving in the sky. Some are more unusual. Seaver's told of a farmer who sighted several of these lights. One orange ball of light hovered over his cattle pen. The next day, the farmer found his calf dead. And that's reporting the same story, I think, here. Hold up. Yeah. The next found surgically removed, according to a report of veterinarians. Who's going into the whole story here, then.
Uh-huh. Expand.
A veterinarian said he couldn't have done a neater job in a lab. The second report came from a man who stopped his car at Lucky Point area to check the quacking holes. A group of five power poles in the area that vibrate violently from time to time when his car was approached from behind by a huge fur-covered being with glowing red eyes. Bigfoot, he's always got glowing red eyes. When I seen him, his eyes were glowing red. So, and I someone was saying it's like they don't think it's light. They think it's the producing.
Yeah.
Like how
yeah. flash it's not light. Eyes shine. It's actually
it's
glow.
The light. It's
yeah.
the blood, like how you stick a flashlight. I was to your hand, and it shows like that, that they're actually producing the light
weird.
Somehow and lighting up at night, and giving some sort of infrared vision
maybe.
To the predator. Carrie Dean Tavernall, Monroe City, here we are in Monroe City again, is a MUFON state section director for Vigo and Clay counties. He said that the poles have been studied and researched by dozens of experts. No explanation for the quaking poles, but has been put forth. Nothing big enough to shake that. The whole ground shakes.
Yeah.
When you move.
Yep.
You can feel it.
This is what I was going to bring up earlier about about those poles shaking.
Yeah. That's what everything goes quiet for. Mm-hmm. Here it feels the tremors, and that's why all the bugs go quiet, all the crickets stop, because they feel that stuff.
Yep.
The third and strangest Lucky Point example came from a report given to Tavernall by a sheriff's department deputy in November 1984. The county policeman had stopped in the area to stretch his legs when he saw a large black triangle 100 feet on his side, less than 200 feet away. He also said he saw small, slender beings with large heads peering from the windows of the ship. The report has also said that from beings communicated with the deputy telepathically.
I was wrong. It wasn't the tall ones. It was this one.
Tavernall said Indiana MUFON members at first thought the black triangle was a unique sighting, but later learned there have been many similar sightings across the U.S. Seavers and Tavernall used to teach a class at Vincent's University on unexplained phenomena. So, okay, they were there at the university. They used to tell students that if they spent 5 nights in the Lucky Point area, they would see something they could not explain. To their knowledge, no one has proven them wrong.
It's that common.
The primary purpose of the symposium of MUFON, according to Francis L. Ridge, the state director of MUFON is to exchange information and to improve communication channels. He said last year's symposium and UFO Information Week resulted in 30 UFO reports of both old and new sightings. Hollywood theatrics and skeptics have made MUFON attempts to study and investigate the UFO phenomenon difficult. But he said times are changing. Yeah, they truly are.
Especially now.
Yes. Oh, yeah, within the last 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
Especially. Ever since the UFO picture, or the alien picture in the desert. How many people got to see that thing? The Mysteries of Lucky Point. Submitted by D.V. Pyle, Washington, Indiana. Right there.
Right there.
July 16th, 1997. In southern Indiana, there is an area which some researchers of paranormal claim is a focal point of paranormal activity, and such areas known as Lucky Point has become a focal point for investigators by members of the Unexplained Phenomenon Research Group. The swampy wooded area that is located in rural Knox County near the town of Monroe City, according to the strange occurrences have reported over the years. The Explained Phenomenon Research Organization, UPRO, acronym. This is a national group dedicated to investigating unexplained supernatural mysteries. The Indiana chapter of the group is headed by Jerry Sievers out of his home in Vincennes, Indiana. We have reports of sightings of Sasquatch, spook lights, ghosts in the area, Sievers commenting. I guess this is him telling his story again to everybody else.
I think I tried to make it so that it wasn't all repeats. I've expanded on some things and I took some things out so that it wasn't.
Prominent mystery involves two utility poles buried in concrete, which some witnesses have claimed is earth shaking. So this is the same one on here. There are two sets of double poles buried in concrete with a road running between them. Seaver said, people up at Lucky Point watching the UFOs have reported hearing the poles rattle. So when they go over, it shakes everything.
I think it's totally independent. It's not always in line with UFO sightings. Sometimes they just shake.
We do set on fall. We do have earthquakes here every year.
So. Exactly.
Nothing like Japan right now. Sorry again for
Japan. Yeah, Japan. New Year started and the Earth's just like, screw you.
Here you go. Here's another one.
Yeah.
But man, I thought about it and like all them people in California, something's going to happen. All them waves crashing into California and all the people get sucked in by me seeing that video.
Yeah.
Something had to happen at the end of all that.
Yeah.
Ground was going all the way from there, shaking from Japan.
I saw a really cool video of people that were scuba diving when the earthquake hit.
Really?
Yeah. And they had a camera, like an underwater camera. And like all of a sudden, like all the fish just leave. And then you see all the dust come up off of the seabed.
Oh, man.
It was nuts.
Like the fish, they could tell.
They knew. Yeah, and they got out.
The RMC, the utility company responsible for maintaining the poles has denied there's any problem with the poles. However, Sievers claims company representatives know what the pole. Know about the poles, but I've told them they cannot determine the reason for the rattling poles.
I still think it's a fault line.
Fault line or set that concrete setting in that dirt ain't gonna set well over here if they've been there that long. It shakes. Stuff shakes when it's all wind. We live in the windiest place in the country. Comes right off of the mountains out west and hits right down on us, and we get it. We get it pretty bad here. Springtime, especially. Witnesses who have heard the noise and reported it is said to have said it is reported is to have said it could not be the electricity. So it's not vibrating from the current.
Right.
Sometimes the vibrations are so extreme that the insulators holding the wire will jar and rattle. Sievers said that in the 1980s, a researcher said the underground sound was caused by magnetic activity. He added that geologists discounted his theory. Fellow UPRP member Sharon Smith said she believes there is something very spooky about the Lucky Point area. Smith says she is sensitive to supernatural activities and can sense the presence of spirits.
We'll leave it alone. She might be dead. I don't
know. Yes.
Talk ill of her.
Uh-huh. My son and I were both out there one day. We both seen something else was there. The hair on the back of my neck stood up. He started into the woods, but turned back. It is Smith's belief that the area is protected by the spirits of the Native Americans who used to live on the land. The Lucky Point area at one point might be a burial ground. I believe everyone has psychic powers which can act as windows and doorways into places, Smith said. The area first started to become popular for UFO watchers in the 1970s and continues to be a popular gathering spot. Lots of people have offered up different explanations for the mysterious activities, some of which Seavers himself has had a hard time believing. Some physics have claimed that there is an underground hangar for outer spaceships in the area. I've never heard that one.
That was new to me too. I've never saw it anywhere else.
But there is no proof. That will have to be proven to me, but there has been a lot of speculation about it. Oh, and here we are getting into his transcript.
Okay, yeah, this is some really good stuff.
Podcast.
This is really good stuff. Make sure you got your foil on tight.
Yeah. It probably looks like crap.
Oh, it's beautiful.
The Mohawk had to do something. Episode 13 of Eriax. Yeah, I know the Eriax. I used to listen to it years ago. Yeah, so this is 2000, like I said, 2007, right after we all started out there.
Yeah.
Working line 80, old school line 80, God. You guys out there at work out there that know old school line 80 train off.
Good times.
Remember how bad it sucked. Just so glad you had good people that could work. Oh, man, those were good times before the robots.
You think about it? Planting the seeds of the uprising.
Yep. Since 1981, I have narrowed my research. I deal mostly now with people that are abducted. Okay, so he went from just sightings to abduction cases.
Yep.
I'm not so interested in proving that these things are abducting people. I'm trying to more or less present the feeling of terror that these people have. I've seen witnesses put under that begin screaming when you ask them questions of what's. But yeah, that's why I don't want to have to be hypnotized, because I think of. Don't want nothing like that happen. My God, just my brother talking about it. I'm like, I don't want to talk about stuff, kids, because your mind's weird.
I've got somewhere over there. I have Hypnosis for Beginners over there. The book Hypnosis for Beginners. Like, you want me to learn?
Put me under.
Yeah.
And ask me questions. I don't know.
Come on, man.
Anyway, we had a case down in Evansville. These two gentlemen were Indian artifact hunting, so they arrowhead hunting or just looking for anything. They came across a 7-foot grave, at least a 7-foot skeleton with a huge head. Shortly after that, the field they're in, right next to the Ohio River, they think they hear a boat coming down the river. But see nothing. Eventually, at the edge of the 40-acre field, a bunch of birds are startled from the tree line, and they see a shadow on the ground that's coming towards them. When they look up, they can see the reflection in the mirror-finished craft. There's a hole in the bottom, and one of the guys passed out right then. The other gentleman said that he was awake until they got inside the UFO. So they dug up some old skeleton, elongated from being in the ground, 7 foot tall. Native American people were tall. Screwy back, they downsized him just like old Napoleon back. Napoleon is not 5'2". He's like, 5'8"?
Yeah, something like that.
The whole thing is why he always painted so short. Look inferior.
Yep.
They always painted him standing over the Indians, Native Americans, to make him look inferior.
Sure.
And actually, all in all, they're actually pretty tall.
Yeah.
I mean, Pocahontas was only 6 foot tall, and John Smith was 5'2". I think we've talked about that before.
We did. Yeah.
They were tall people, so it makes sense.
That's not how it was in the cartoon.
If Tuscaloosa was 7 foot tall and his sons were 7 foot tall, then the other Native American tribes had 7 foot tall people.
Sure.
Yep.
Sure.
It happens. He said lights came down over the men and they were physically lifted up into the UFO. And it was weird because his point of equilibrium changed. He was no longer standing but being pulled up by the chest. The next thing he remembered was looking out of the portal or the porthole in the middle and could see that it was dark outside and he could see the gray site below them. It was started getting smaller and smaller, and he realized it must be moving away from Earth. It took him up, guessing all the people that went up in space and they didn't know about it.
Maybe you.
Might have. Maybe.
Good thing we got these helmets on.
Yeah, Jack says they can't read our minds.
Can't read our minds.
He said Several hours later, although they don't immediately realize it, they find themselves walking to the vehicle. They'd gone out at 10:30 a.m. and it came to them that it was getting dark. They were at least there for several hours because by that time they got back to Evansville, it was full dark and they were only 15, 20 miles away from Evansville. Talked about this with my boss. They were coming back from working one night. They're 45 minutes away and the two of them were coming back from work and where they left over there by the lake on the back way around back here, they said Freebird started on the radio and when they were pulling in the driveway, 25 minutes later, 35 minutes later, Freebird was still on the radio.
That's weird.
Yeah. And he's like, I was telling him, we're going to see something on the night, one of these nights out on the road. We're going
right.
to see something all the time we're on the road. He's like, and that's what he said, like, because we got abducted that night. He's like, I know it. He's like, Freebird's a long song. He's like, it ain't 30 minutes long. They pulled in the driveway and he said they were just looking at each other. And then Freebird's still on the radio.
That's weird.
I was like, you guys had to change the channel and heard it again. You know how those songs are playing.
Yeah, sure.
And this is in the same area. Same reports we're getting here from actual people we know about the orange orbs. Because yeah. that's mostly the one I get from here is about orange orbs in the sky. Very few crafts. They asked my team if they could do anything to help. They agreed to be hypnotized. Uh-oh, here we go.
Yep.
The first gentleman was put under by clinical hypnosis, who does this for a living and has had never heard of a story like this before. When put back to that time, he started screaming. He screamed for 10 minutes, and the hypnotist said that they couldn't stand much more of it and brought him out. And one guy, well, he retired and destroyed all the stuff. We'll get into that one of these episodes, too.
Sure.
The godfather of that. They didn't like what he was doing. The other gentleman remembered more of what happened. There are a few other facts I won't go into right now. And probably because of stuff they did. No one wants to. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yep. He was lying on the couch also. When he started talking about it, he raised up. His heels and the back of his head were the only things touching the couch. And the hypnotist got him calmed down enough that he was finally relaxed and laid on his straight couch. So, would he shoot up kind of like the exorcist?
Well, he said that he was still conscious when they were being taken. And he said his equilibrium changed and he felt he was being pulled up by his chest. So, when he starts reliving it through hypnosis, his body is doing the same thing. It's like that Fourth Kind movie with Mila Jovovich.
That was so scary.
That was a good movie. Yeah, I love it.
They're showing you the actual stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like,
I think it was all made up.
But that's what pissed me off. Why are they cutting, showing you?
But it was a cool, like, idea.
Yeah, it was scary.
And it was a scary movie.
It was the first time you watch it, you're like, oh, yeah, this is actually pretty scary. Because this is before people started talking about it.
Yeah,
that was
sure.
One of the movies that really progressed as far as it
I think so.
Fourth Kind, yeah. Better than those ones with the ghosts and the footprints. What were those ones called? I couldn't watch that stuff. God. Dragging people out of your bed. Ah! I'm convinced that these people are put through some kind of experience, whether it's objective or subjective. It's hard to say. I dealt with two dozen of these types of cases, and there's a pattern to it.
I would like to know more about the other cases he's dealt with, because, his records are all gone, so.
Yes. Yeah. I'm pretty sure they're all gone.
I couldn't find very much about his work, which sucks.
Sure, skip a page here. As far as we can figure, there are 5-mile radius where stuff is happening. The activity is nearly non-existent in the daylight. In the early 60s, I came across a gentleman that had been investigating this stuff on his own for several years. So there's some back before you could record everything and tell your story. Your private investigator did it as a hobby. He had seen something too, I guarantee. If you got unexplainable and kept thinking about it or dreaming about it and had to.
Yeah.
I came across a gentleman here. We've been in contact for over 30 years and stuff is still happening down. So met the guy in the 60s and they still talk about stuff. So he's getting that. The stories too, like people telling me stories. In the last week, I've had people tell me a bunch of shit.
You're welcome.
Yeah, people come, oh, yeah, I watched it the other day. He's like, yeah, I was 12 years old. We were on top of the freaking grain bins down here, and then we seen the light. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah. I was like, write it down. It was like long enough, but if you just seen the light, cool. I was like, yeah, it's cool. I've seen the lights. I've never seen anything else. The lights one time, and then the orb at the
cemetery
thing.
At the cemetery too, we saw the one.
Yeah, the cemetery. Yeah, it just shot across the sky. Like it looked like a meteor, but it wasn't a meteor.
No,
meteors disappear.
Yeah,
and they break up in the atmosphere. Yeah. They don't fly straight across the sky.
Flew straight across, flashed, and disappeared.
From the mid '60s right up to the end of the '80s, there are literally hundreds of sightings in that area. It's so bad that the town marshal from Monroe City, which is about 3 miles away, had to go down and direct traffic and order people to leave the area because it was a safety issue. There were people all over the road in the dark during that period. It went down there 3 nights a week as though the sightings you would see in a UFO. So people are coming over here hanging out in the 70s.
Yeah.
Because that's what they did in the 70s. These small areas were not as progressed as far. And the path was... And forests weren't cut down and piled up yet either, so there was a more of a wooded and secluded area. Yep. I mean, it still is, but it's not like it was then. A lot of farmland now compared to before. We had hundreds of cases of close encounters in the mid-70s. There was a Knox County Sheriff's Depot that stopped in the area to stretch his legs, looking south over his cruiser, and there was a black triangle hovering with either a long window or like 5 portholes over the edge.
This is the story.
Facing him. So, it is. Black triangle, so it's got to have some, like a boomerang, but with the windows, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. This is the little guy's telepathically communicating.
Yeah.
This is so good.
He claims that he received a telepathic message from one or all of these figures, and they asked and why he hated the Iranians. He thought to himself, well, I don't hate anybody. There's three other groups are in the middle, two on each side. The two on the outside turned to look at ones in the middle. They took off in like three seconds. There's only two things I hate in life, and that's when you make fun of another man's culture and the Dutch. Gold member?
Yep. Imagine though, like, you're a sheriff's deputy, you're out patrolling, you know, you stop, stretch your legs at Lucky Point, you see a black triangle, and you see little guys up in a window, and then you hear in your head, why do you hate the Iranians? And you think to yourself, well, I don't hate the Iranians, I don't really hate anybody, and then they're like, alright,
pew! Yeah, they just be off later then.
Yeah, isn't that nuts?
We thought you hated him. I guess we're not.
It's one of my favorite stories.
Why? Yeah, why? Did he interpret it as Iranians? Or
no?
Maybe that's what they call themselves on the planet, Iranians?
Maybe they were doing like a societal case study and trying to figure out why we're at war with each other all the time.
That's true. That's true, because I've seen the stuff that's coming out now, and we're progressing closer and closer to another war. And with how we have progressed with military, it's not even war.
Mm-hmm.
It's bomb to say.
Yeah. Well, you can go back to Uri Geller and the other guy that teamed up with him for a while. And I think Uri Geller is from somewhere in the Middle East. And like he started getting these communications from this being that was allegedly like a robot computer on a ship called the Spectra from a planet called the Huba or something like that. Anyway, like they're using Uri Geller allegedly to prevent wars from breaking out between whatever country he was from and Egypt at the time. It might have been it wasn't Saudi Arabia. I don't remember if he was from Iran, Iraq,
maybe
somewhere over there. Anyway. But like, there's always seems to be some sort of an interest, and then you get into like the nuclear missiles being diffused and stuff like that with UFOs.
Yeah, Rendlesham Forest, the whole all that.
Yeah, stuff. So there's a lot of interest in war, which kind of just I don't know. I hate to say it, but kind of makes me think it's more likely that it's humans like interfering, like government, military, and secret craft.
Mm-hmm.
In some of those cases, not all.
When someone finds out too much,
yeah,
to find a way to silence them, and the best way to do is make some sort of paranormal activity happen. Yeah.
Puharich was the other guy. That's the
now this guy. Now we can silence this guy because everybody thinks he's wacky.
Right. Exactly. And exactly. Yeah.
Back in the early 60s, we started getting reports of these black triangles. As far as I know, those were the first incidents of the black triangles showing up in the United States, all the way back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've researched it, I can't find any before 62 or 63. And that was right after we built all the radar during Cold War, going through all of Cold War, building all our defense systems all over the United States. So they're tracking us too.
Yep.
They're tracking every move. Anytime anybody builds anything, split an atom.
We were also probably working on the stealth bombers too, which were triangle shaped.
Yes.
And so.
You might have been seeing those too.
Yeah.
That's true.
And early, before they started painting them black, they were just metallic.
Yes, they were metallic.
Unfinished. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, in the sunlight, it would
look like a gleam.
Yeah.
Yep. Big gleam of light going across the sky. Yep. Fast as anything we'd ever seen.
Yep.
There was a bunch of farmers combining crops, and a combine broke down. That was at like 10:30 at night. So, they go get tools and work lights to fix it and come back. They're out there working on this, and the black triangle comes out of the south, and it gets within a quarter mile from them, and all the lights, engines, motors, everything quits. Everything. So they electromagnetic field.
Mm-hmm. The EMP.
You hear that everywhere, and you hear the stories how they control their vehicles, too. That's weird.
Yeah.
Even these are old vehicles, too, without all the electronics.
Right.
This is still steel-bodied and
mm-hmm.
good stuff. Not made now, but plastic, everything. Plastic existence. This thing stops and is hovering about 200 feet from them, and while they're watching it, an orange ball drops out of the craft, comes toward them, shifts over, and comes up. Kissinger Creek, under the bridge, over the bridge, under the bridge again, and over the bridge again, and then upside, back up inside the black triangle again. The triangle moves away to the south, and when it gets about it, mile away, the power to the engine's lights comes back on. It must have been a huge EMP.
Yep.
Yep. And it radiates off of them. They can use it as a weapon. Mm. That stops any of our electronics from working.
Yep.
Cameras are distorted. Cars, electronics die. Battery drained.
Yep.
That goes out like War of the Worlds. All they had to do was change it. Cars work again.
Yeah, solenoids.
Yep, solenoids. During all that time, there was other stuff going on, like cattle mutilations and spirit lights. According by urban legend, there's a cabin up there on the ridge where a family was murdered by their mother. When the father came home, she killed him and then herself. What people see is a lady in a glowing, long, and white gown walking the ridge. It's been seen several times. There's been at least 3 cattle mutilations in the area.
Lucky point, man. Lots going on out there.
How far is it from Snake Mounds?
I don't know.
And that's Ohio, right?
Yeah, it's like southeast Ohio. I mean, it's quite a ways.
Quite a ways, but not.
I mean, if you're flying at the speed of light, it's nothing. to drive it, though, yeah. In a car. So Lucky Point, we definitely need to get out there and check it out sometime.
Yeah, that's one of the areas, Lucky Point, because I've heard about that, too, mm-hmm. many times.
Now, we've talked about it a lot.
Yeah, I remember watching the shows in the 80s. Remember when Unsolved Mysteries first came out?
Oh, yeah.
Late 80s, early 90s. Really changed from Men in Black. I remember that's when all of my grandpa started. When that Men in Black, we had HBO, and it came on, we watched it one day. And that's when it all started, hearing what he had to say about it.
Yeah, it's wild. Same. I really want to talk about that. I know you want to get all your ducks in a row. Yeah. And anyway, hey, if you've been to Lucky Point, or if you've heard of Lucky Point, or if you've seen a UFO in Indiana, Illinois, or anywhere, give us a call or a text at our hotline, Keith. You know the number?
I don't remember it.
It's 765-665-6488. And we'll put it on the screen as well. For those of you watching on YouTube, if you're just listening to the audio, that's the number. And we'll go over it again later.
Yeah, if you're from Indiana, any of that region.
Yeah, yeah.
Still north to the eastern part, it all to the same area.
UFO hotspot. Yep. We're talking transdimensional vessels. Up next, Special guest interview, Nathan Isaac of the Penny Royal podcast of Somerset, fucking Kentucky.
Do we have what set up for after that?
After that, we're going to be back and I'm going to talk about the Mantell incident, the Kentucky UFO crash. Or okay. Not the UFO didn't crash, the pilot crash, but we'll talk about that very soon. So stick around and enjoy this special guest interview. Nathan Isaac, welcome back to the Paranormal Patio, my friend. How are you?
I'm fantastic, man. Thanks for having me back on again, dude.
Thanks so much for coming back on.
Yeah.
Got a lot of irons in the fire right now, Mr. Isaac. And I know Hidden in the Herd is a little ways away, but hopefully this year?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be, the episodes are way shorter than Penny Royal and it's very focused, you know, it's a very focused story. So, it's only going to be like a limited series, 6 episodes, probably about 30 minutes each. So yeah, it's going to happen this year, later this year for sure. So.
Perfect. You've been kind of doing the production on it, like behind the scenes of season 3 of Penny Royal, like concurrently, right?
Yeah. I mean, Penny Royal is one of those things where it, you know, because I'm looking into all these like strange things and how they relate to Somerset, it ends up tying into other stories. You know, it's that there's a lot of it in season 2, but season 3 has a lot of that stuff as well. And you know, from just the research you and I do and talk about that so many of these things end up being intertwined with one another. So it just,
absolutely.
It was like, while I was doing it, I was like, I might as well ask this guest about cattle mutilations also, because instead of interviewing him again, I'll just use this and the other thing. So yeah, no, it was great.
Yeah.
It's worked out really well, you know? So.
Yeah. Actually, when we were just talking about Lucky Point, Keith and I, there was a line from an interview with, Jerry Seavers, who was the Indiana MUFON associate director or assistant director, until he passed away less than a decade ago. But he had mentioned that there were several cattle mutilations in the Lucky Point area. One specifically, a calf had an egg-shaped hole cut into its head and its brain removed. It was verified by a veterinarian that he could not have done more precise work in his lab.
That's pretty interesting, man. I'm going to have to look at that case now. Well, what year was that? When did that happen? When did the...
I'm not sure. Sometime between 1970 and 2000. Okay. So that's kind of a big window. But if I dig up more on it, I'll send it to you for sure. Especially because of the relevance of Hidden in the Herd and how... Well, I don't want to spoil it, but you kind of dig into these cattle mutilation stories out west.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And well, I'm really curious about that one because of the hole in its head, right? The third eye sort of thing, you know?
And I wonder about the placement of the hole because it wasn't addressed. A guy who was only studying UFO phenomena and abduction reports towards the end of his career. But yeah, like that would be interesting to know. It probably wouldn't have been on his radar to even report on that, the location of the hole. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It would be interesting if it was like right in the middle of its forehead.
Yes. Yeah. Right. That's as soon as you said that, I was like, huh? The third eye of a cow. Oh my God.
Yeah. That's interesting. Never even thought of that. Wow.
That's weird.
Anyway, I've asked you here and you have so graciously responded to join me in the patio tonight to talk about Hidden in the Herd and kind of give an abridged version of this big project. I, of course, have been privy to inside information, and I don't care. Ta-ta, suckers. So if you wouldn't mind indulging the fans of the Paranormal Patio, who are probably also fans of Penny Royal, just give us like an abridged version of this Hidden in the Herd story, because it's absolutely captivating.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, you saw the sort of quick presentation of all of this, and it all sort of grew out of the Strange Realities conference presentation I gave this past, I guess that was beginning of November, right, when we were down in Nashville. Fantastic conference. We love those guys. Conspiranormal puts it on. Adam Sane and Surfiel, and yeah, it's awesome. I love going to it, so can't wait till next year.
Time.
Yeah, but originally this was a presentation for that, and honestly, it grew out of a lot of the weird research we were doing for Pennyroyal, and I was wondering, and some of the Downard research, right? And I was wondering about alchemical rituals out west and whether or not these cattle that were being found, you know, drained of blood in Colorado's mineral region, right? I was like, is there a correlation between all of these minerals and blood? And it sounds like alchemy, right? And and that, like, honestly, that's what I started looking for, right? I was like, is there some type of weird alchemical shit here? But then the deeper I got into it, and I really started looking at the cattle mutilation phenomena and started pulling newspaper reports, kept seeing the number that there were 10,000 mutilations in the 1970s. And the operative period here is really 1972 through about 1979. And when you think of cattle mutilations in America, that's the period, right? And
absolutely.
And also, though, I mean, that's the period when, you know, for Pennyroyal, at least, that's the 1970s are a major, you know, point in the story. And honestly, that's why I was looking at some of that stuff, too. But in terms of the UFO phenomena, 72, 73, you know, there were these huge UFO flaps. I think, was it 72? That's the year of the humanoid. Rosales calls the year of the humanoid. And yeah, so it's a weird time, and definitely there were a lot of weird sightings of things, but also it was a strange time socioeconomically, politically, you know, lots of things were happening. So anyway, I was looking at the alchemical sort of angle to this and saw this number that there were 10,000 cattle mutilations. But when you start pulling the newspaper reports, there just aren't 10,000. And I really became intrigued by it, started filing FOIA requests through muckrock.com, which I love. You can file tons and tons of FOIA requests. They help you, you know, track everything and hassle the government, hassle the different departments. And so I started, because in 75, there was an investigation by the Colorado Bureau of Investigation and a bunch of the other states in the Midwest, 21 of them. And they tried to get the FBI involved, but the FBI, because there wasn't any evidence of interstate activity, they wouldn't engage with the investigation. And you can get the FBI files online, and they're not so much about cattle mutilations as they are about the jurisdictional red tape that prevented them from investigating cattle mutilations, right? And you find out that they actually only investigated 15 cattle mutilations during this period in the 1970s, and they were all on Native American reservations, which there's a great article. I can't think of the name of it right now, but I'll send it to you if you want to provide it to people so they can read it. But this great article about the fact that it's written by a Native American scholar, and it's about the fact that the FBI became the aliens that were invading Native American reservations looking for mutilated cows, right? So
that's terrific.
Right?
Absolutely terrific.
So the there wasn't really anything with the FBI. I file all these FOIA requests. I end up finally getting the Colorado Bureau of Investigation files. They did charge me $800 to have them redacted. No one else had gotten them. Yeah, right. $800. I was like, oh shit. But I had to have them, and it was apparently, according to all these newspaper articles, the largest investigation in the history of the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, and they were the ones leading this sort of interstate project to figure out what was going on, and they acted like there weren't any documents. Then I sent them all the newspaper clippings, and I'm like, obviously there are documents. They finally find them. They charge me all that money to redact them because no one else had asked for these since the 1970s. And I got them. There were only about 300 pages. A lot of the stuff they said were lies, that they didn't actually investigate a lot of this stuff. And yeah, there just wasn't that much there. And definitely it proved that there were not 10,000 cases. But one of the biggest things that I found, and we cover all this stuff in Hidden in the Herd, it's sort of like a short documentary, an audio documentary about my investigation into this, right? And how this sort of unfolded. But one of the major sources of documentation of all of this and for all these newspaper articles was a guy named Dane Edwards, who was a newspaper reporter and the editor of a really tiny newspaper called the Brush Banner in Brush, Colorado. And Colorado has a great historical archive of all of its small newspapers. And so you can get all these articles that this guy, Dane Edwards, wrote. And so when he was writing these articles, they were getting picked up and published by the Associated Press, all of these other newspapers. And so he would write an article about cattle mutilations. He was really on the front line of this. You know, he's in Colorado. All this stuff's happening at Colorado Springs and that whole area. And Elbert County, Colorado. So he would publish these articles, and then they would go out to like 4,200 newspapers. So everybody in the country is reading this. He's fanning the flames of this panic about cattle mutilations. And he says he's working with the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. Everyone is saying it's a fucking cult, right? That there's a satanic cult behind this. And another thing that emerged that is central to the story, probably one of the biggest pieces, is that when cattle mutilations were happening in the 1970s, we all think of them as being associated with UFOs. But at that time, yeah, they weren't associated heavily with UFOs. They were associated with sightings of unmarked black helicopters. So everybody thought that there was a well-funded satanic cult and that they were flying around and they were mutilating these cows and flying off. Right. So, Dane Edwards, he kind of leans into this, says he's figured out what's going on. He knows what's up and, he's going to reveal everything. And then the fucker vanishes, right? Like he goes missing. And it's like this great headline. Dane, you know, editor of Brush Banner disappears. And it's like right before he reveals what he's discovered. And I thought, when I saw that too, like early on in finding all the stuff, I thought, this is incredible. This is going to be the greatest story ever, right? This guy had to have gone missing because he got too close to the truth, right?
Yeah.
Well, then later you find out that Dane Edwards was a con man, right? And that he was on his like second family at the time, and he vanishes and then moves to Texas. And his whole life, he was a con man that had multiple lives, multiple families, lived in multiple states. And that was the guy that was telling all of these stories about cattle mutilations that were getting picked up and pumped out to the whole country, and then causing this panic, right? So I cover that in the story. The other thing that was sort of happening concurrently with this, and this is really the stuff that kind of blew my mind. That blew my mind that Dane Edwards was not who he said he was, right? What a great twist, you know? <It's> like, duh, 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 you know? The other thing that was crazy is at the time that this was happening, it was the worst economic crisis in the cattle industry, right? And the 70s were just, it was a crazy time. There was an energy crisis. There was a food shortage. Grain was being sent to Africa and other countries because people were starving. That caused the price of grain to go up, which caused the price of feed for cattle to go up. There was inflation, and so the cost of beef went up as well at the grocery store. Lots of housewives actually banded together and boycotted buying beef because of the prices, but they were so high. and all of this stuff comes together, right? And it causes what cattlemen in the cattle industry called the wreck. And it almost wiped out the entire cattle industry. Also, like, I think 140 slaughterhouses closed. Like, it was crazy, the crisis that happened. And that was at exactly the same time that the Bureau of Land Management decided to tell these ranchers that they could no longer use federal lands to graze their millions of heads of cattle. So it was like, it cost too much to feed the cattle. It cost too much to bring them to market. And it actually was cheaper to kill the cow than it was to let the cow live for these guys, right? Plus, now they couldn't use the federal land. This all led to something called, and I've never heard of this before. I guess maybe if you lived out west, maybe it's something that's familiar, but I wish they had taught this in school. It's called the Sagebrush Rebellion. And these ranchers were basically banding together to fight the federal government over this, you know, the deprivation of land rights by the Bureau of Land Management. And so you've got these ranchers, they're pissed at the government, and then enter the John Birch Society and all of these right-wing extremist militias. And you've got the Vietnam War going on. You've got soldiers coming back from Vietnam. They're being mistreated. You know, basically they're being treated as pariahs in society. There's no jobs for them, anything like that. And so these right-wing extremist groups are like, hey, with open arms, you know, we'll take you in. You know, you've got military training. The government hates you. This society hates you. Help us overthrow the government, right? So this is exactly the period when the Minutemen forms. Robert Depew formed that in Montana. Tons of other right-wing extremist groups. The John Birch Society is infiltrating. I have all these FBI files I got through FOIA requests that indicate that the John Birch Society was infiltrating small sheriff's departments, small town, you know, law enforcement, and trying to radicalize them. And this is where it all came together, right? So I'm looking at all this stuff, looking at all these right-wing extremists. Obviously, that's a big part of the Pennyroyal research. So that sort of, you know, intersected there. But the John Birch Society is the originator of this idea of a black helicopter. 1967, they mentioned this in their American Opinion magazine, and they were spreading all these crazy conspiracy theories that the UN was using black unmarked helicopters to invade the United States as communists. And so there's this weird moment where and this is really what I'm kind of arguing in Hidden in the Herd, is that these right-wing groups, some of these right-wing extremists, and I'm not saying it was the John Birch Society specifically, just that there were former members of the John Birch Society, this ultra sort of right-wing group, that were possibly using this narrative of black helicopters, right? And influencing and also fanning the flames of panic, right? Because it's like, you hate the government. The same thing with the ranchers, right? They want to, you know, overthrow the government, hate the federal government, anti-federal government. It's like, hey, let's all band together. Well, the other thing that's weird about all this is that Edward Lansdale, this general who served in the Southeastern theater of war, in the Korean War, in Vietnam, he was the guy that pioneered this idea of psychological warfare, where he would train American soldiers to stage psychological warfare attacks on groups by say, like, capturing an enemy soldier, draining them of blood, making it look like a vampire had attacked them, and then leaving them upside down in a tree, right? And so they were he was notorious for this. He trained all these people. It's a really famous kind of story about psychological warfare. Well, those groups that he was training, those soldiers, they were coming back to the U.S. and then finding themselves in cahoots with some of these right-wing paramilitary groups, right? And this Robert Depew, right, that started the Minutemen, he was also a biochemist and a veterinarian, and he had a company called Biochem Labs. And he forms this military paramilitary group, right-wing extremist group, gets all of these Vietnam vets and other people too, ranchers, and writes a book on guerrilla warfare and psychological warfare tactics to overthrow the U.S. government. And he started stockpiling nicotine sulfate. He said it was his favorite chemical that he wanted to use basically in a domestic terrorism attack. Well, when I got all these fucking documents from the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, and I had seen it in referenced in other investigations like Christopher O'Brien, who's very famous for covering all of this stuff, but also other researchers, they had mentioned nicotine sulfate was being found in these cattle mutilations. And so you've got this veterinary biochemist in Montana and operating in this whole area, Colorado, Minnesota, where this stuff's happening. And these black helicopters, the John Birch Society, the Sagebrush Rebellion, and then all of these ranchers who there were also the possibility that these ranchers were also killing their cattle for insurance claims, right? Which makes sense
yeah.
in the midst of all of this turmoil, right? You put all that stuff together and boom, you've got this cattle mutilation panic. And one other thing too that I found that was really strange was that there were black helicopters at this time. And it was actually Howard Hughes in 1968 was hired by the Department of Defense to create a black helicopter. It's a Hughes 500 helicopter for use in the Vietnam War. And it is the same helicopter that is used by ranchers to basically corral their herds out in the big ranches. So Hughes took one of those helicopters and turned it into the most quiet helicopter ever built. And it still remains today, this Hughes 500 aircraft. There's a great article in Popular Science has this great expose about this and about Howard Hughes's involvement in this and its use domestically by police departments, right, for surveillance. And I'm telling you, man, there's some weird stuff. And this is, we cover all of this in Hidden in the Herd and basically piece together the influence of these right-wing extremist groups and this whole Sagebrush Rebellion on the cattle mutilation phenomenon. And the guy that wrote the article about the Sagebrush Rebellion, and he actually connects it to cattle mutilations and asks some of these questions. His name is Michael Goldman. And if you look up the cattle mutilations on Wikipedia, you'll find reference to his article. You can read it online. Absolutely great sort of historical article about the Sagebrush Rebellion. And then he mentions the cattle mutilations. So I'm like, I got to talk to this guy. So I look him up and it turns out that he lives in fucking Somerset, Kentucky and teaches at the local college. And I was like, are you kidding me? Right. Yeah, man, that's the quick and dirty, hidden in the herd sort of story arc. All of that is told over six episodes, short episodes, but where I cover each one of those things. And really, man, what I end up arguing in at the end of it is that panic, right, that happened, and there's a lot of other great stories in there, but that panic that happened is what directly led to the satanic panic, right? And yeah. And it's opened up, as you know, right? It has opened up this whole other mystery into a man named Donald Flickinger. And I think that's going to end up being a follow-up. So it's like Hidden in the Herd, 6 episodes, and then A Tale of Two Flickingers.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking forward to the day that that is unleashed upon the world, because that's such a wild story. Absolutely wild. You know, like, there's coincidences, and then there's A Tale of Two Flickingers. It's so wild.
It's so weird, dude.
Like, okay, obviously this episode is about UFOs, and the reason I wanted you to talk about the cattle mutilation stuff is because there's this pop culture recognition of, like, aliens abducting cows. Like, where do you think that exactly stems from?
I definitely think that it stems from Linda Moulton Howe. Probably had the biggest hand in it. When this all happened at the beginning, right before the whole cattle mutilation phenomena, or panic, I guess, happened, there was the original mutilation, which was not a cow. It was a horse named Snippy. It was Snippy, but the horse had another name. I can't remember what it is right now, but they misnamed it in the newspaper article, right? Mm-hmm. But Lady, that's right. The horse's name was Lady. But it was reported as Snippy. I think Snippy was her sire or something like that. Anyway, mm-hmm. But the story of Snippy, the horse that had the flesh of its neck excised, right? Well, during the 24-hour period that supposedly Snippy was mutilated, there was a judge, like a circuit court judge, in that area of Colorado, Alamosa, Colorado, that came forward and said that he saw lights in the sky the same night that Snippy was mutilated, right? And so it is the first story that connects the killing of an animal, right, to the sightings of a UFO. And it sort of was offhand in the newspaper article. But irregardless of that, during the whole period that followed, the black helicopter and a satanic cult was really the dominant narrative. But then you've got Linda Moulton Howe. She comes out with A Strange Harvest in, I think, what, 80 or 81, around the early 80s. And just straight up says it's 100% UFOs, and basically alien surgeons are coming down and using lasers to do this. And like, that narrative never changes and has only been just reinforced by popular culture. And she continues, and many other people continue to push that. And I definitely think some weird shit was happening, and there's a lot of weird alien stuff happening in the same areas that these cattle mutilations were occurring. But I don't think that they were predominantly based on alien activity, right? I think some people were taking advantage of that narrative and using it.
Well, around that same time, you also had the emergence of the Black Triangle UFOs, right? So it's another piece of the puzzle to look at that and how it expanded over time. This is totally unrelated, but I think you'll find comedy in it. I'm going to tell this story. My good friend, Rod, proper name, Rodney. I won't totally dox him. I'm not going to say his last name, but, his whole life, he grew up, his parents had, groceries delivered, like, via horse and buggy. Okay. And he thought, because, you know, you hear something one time when you're a kid, that he was named after the driver of this grocery carriage, Rodney. Turns out, he finds out, I don't know, maybe like 10 years ago, that he was named after the horse whose name was Rodney. But it wasn't a horse. It was a donkey. So he's named after the grocery donkey. And I like to remind him of that every so often. And this is the one for this year. Thank you, Rod.
That's okay. That's funny, dude. I thought you were going to say he saw. I thought you were going to say he saw a black triangle.
Well, he may have. Totally unrelated. I don't know. He may or may not have. Rod, reach out to the hotline. Leave us a voicemail. Let us know about the black UFO you may have seen. I don't know. But yeah, I was. Whenever Snippy and Lady come into the equation, I like to think of Rod and how he's named after a grocery donkey.
That's really funny, man. That's really funny. Do you know, man, on the Snippy case too, like some kids came forward and admitted to killing the horse, but that was, yeah. That's always omitted from, you know, it's not as sexy as alien
virgins,
you know? So,
yeah. Yeah. You know, I didn't talk to you about this beforehand. Would you mind a little Patreon bonus content as a preview for what's going on with season 3 of Pennyroyal?
Yeah, man, sure, dude.
Just some of the highlighted topics.
The big topic that we are going to be talking about is there's no cult, right? Again, I want to reiterate, there's not a cult here in Pulaski County, but I did end up interviewing some people in the White Lily area, the sort of where Mount Victory is. And if anyone's familiar with the show, that's where the Mount Victory mine is. All this weird stuff that we found correlates to that area. That's where the Kentucky anomaly, the peak of it, is centered. And on sort of the edge of the Daniel Boone National Forest. And so I'd interviewed, we were doing production on kind of doing like a pilot for Pennyroyal or for a pitch to turn it into a TV show. And we were actually interviewing some witnesses. And one of those people ends up telling us that they actually weren't one of the children taken in the 1960s and 1970s by a group that were doing something strange. We weren't sure what, and told me that they took a certain number of children every year for this ritual of some sort. And then I was like, well, do you know who, Pamela Richards is? And of course he's like, well, yeah, she's one of the other children. And Pamela in season one is one of the first people that we talked to that mentions this cult around the Mount Victory mine. That's where this guy grew up. They went to school together, the White Lily School. So I'd start digging deeper into that and find all kinds of weird connections to some group or some tradition, I'll say tradition, that was active. I don't think it's active anymore, but I think for a number of decades was active. And so season 3 really has been an extension of, you know, a large part of the investigation is into that to try to figure out what tradition that was, which led us into a lot of Welsh magic and Welsh traditions. The funniest thing that it ties into is the story of King Arthur and the Holy Grail being located in Kentucky, which I always thought was the most ridiculous story ever. However, when you get into it, there's some weird correlations to all of the stuff we're looking at and to a lot of other strange figures that are centered on that spot where the Kentucky anomaly is. We dig deeper into the Bait Cabal and how Cincinnati occultists are really, really tied directly into this whole Kentucky anomaly, the Cincinnati vortex thing. And the other thing that we get deep into also is the connections between Somerset and all of this weird CIA activity at the same time that this stuff's happening at the mine, right? There's a ton of CIA activity, ties into Guterma and ties into the local bank here in Somerset, and a couple of brothers named the Butcher Brothers that were operating out of Knoxville. It gets wrapped up into the Bluegrass conspiracy, all that stuff. So it's weird, man. It's like, all of these things crisscrossed at the same time in the same place and seem to involve a lot of the same people, right?
Yeah.
Some of the people that were involved when the CIA stuff, and this sounds super conspiratorial, but it's not, you know, but it's like some of the people that were tied into the coal mine CIA stuff that was happening with Guterman and all those people. And that those people were also strange preachers and religious figures that were caught up in some illicit sexual activity. There's just a bunch of like, it's like, could these people be the people that were at the mine doing ritual? You know what I'm saying? Like it's some weird stuff. So, those are the questions that we dig into. But for me, the most fun I had researching was looking at the King Arthur connection to the whole Welsh tradition and this idea that, is it possible, that there was a group of Welsh that somehow survived for a period of time and left behind traditions in an enclave of the wilderness, you know, where the Daniel Boone National Forest is. And then somehow it's continued to influence that community, right? But coincidentally, that community is right where the Kentucky anomaly is centered. I don't know. For me, like that again is the strangest thing, is like the way that all this stuff centers in that one area. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I know I'm not alone in looking forward to the next season. Although I know most of everything that's going to be in it, it's still, you know, I had the same thing with season two. It's like, I knew literally almost everything, just from being a member of the Liminal Lodge, which is the Penny Royal Patreon group. You should definitely join up and get in early access to all this information. Even though I knew all of that, then getting to listen to the actual proper presentation of it and the finished product there, man, Penny Royal is such a great rabbit hole to go down. And it's, you know, it's remarkably well done. And I'm always impressed, you know, by what you do with all these projects, and I'm looking forward to it and everything else that's going on. Hidden and Heard is just, you have no idea what it's going to be next. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like every revelation is going to be, okay, well, that's what it is. And that's, but then it turns again. And then all of a sudden there's all these other people involved with something else. And it just keeps you like literally on the edge of your seat, trying to figure out like, what the hell, like, what were these people doing? How did this all come around? And I think you've done, you know, just tremendous research, and you have really pieced together something that people have just taken for granted as being either Satanists or UFOs. And that's what it is to most people, but you pulled the curtain back and you're like, well, you know, maybe it wasn't. And I, you know, it's such a great story, and there's so many weird things that happen. The Flickinger thing is really weird. I think people are really going to dig that. And, like all of it's really great, but that's probably my favorite part of the whole mess.
Me too. That's my favorite too, man. Thanks too, man. Thanks for saying all that. Like, I really love, you know, telling these stories and finding this stuff and putting it together into a narrative that makes it accessible. Cause it is a lot of this stuff, man. It's all so weird and all over the place. And it's like, how do you pull this together in a way that, people can digest it and see, you know what I mean? See the connections. Cause fuck, man, there's so many people and so many things and that tie to this stuff. And that, I guess that's what makes it all sound so conspiratorial. Right. But
yeah.
But I do think, like you said, everybody thinks UFOs are satanic cults. Right. But there was something else going on. And it was like, even like the reality of what was going on is way weirder to me than UFOs or Satanists. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It just goes to show you, man, like maybe you and I aren't the weirdos. You know? Like, we're it's innocent true, of all dude. Charges.
That's true, man. It's you know? Totally true. It's totally true.
And I mean, we are weird.
Yeah. Yes. But I'm telling you, the Flickinger thing, though, is like, that is a whole story arc that I couldn't believe. Because I remember the night that we were like, you know, we're doing the live stream and we talked about the other guy that was in the room when he was interrogating Kenneth Bankston, this prisoner that tells him about this weird satanic cult called the Sons of Satan. And it's like, oh, well, there was this former paratrooper commando in the room with him, right? In the interrogation in the prison. And I thought, okay, well, that's weird. I'll have to come back to that. And it was like right after we got off the live stream, I Googled that guy's name and he was a fucking CIA agent that was involved in the Bay of Pigs and trying to assassinate Castro. And I'm like, what was this special agent for the ATF, Donald Flickinger, doing running around with a partner who was a CIA agent? And for months they were chasing down a satanic cult trying to steal nuclear weapons and mutilating cows, right?
It's so bizarre. Like, to even hear that sentence out loud is just one of the experiences of life you'll never forget. A satanic cult trying to steal nuclear weapons while mutilating cattle. Yeah, it's totally definitely what happened. It's definitely what was going on. That's so unlikely. That's like somebody shook a bag of ideas up and drew them out.
I know, right?
You know, it's like some party game.
But what's great about it, though, is that there's a little bit of truth to every part of it. And that's what kept them going in the investigation. It's like, well, someone did try to steal nuclear
I love it, man. Thank you so much for giving us a teaser, and I'm sure that everyone will be on the lookout now for Hidden in the Herd. If they're not, they should be. Get with it. Where will people be able to find that? Where can they follow you now to stay up to date? All of that good stuff. The whole plug machine here.
Yeah, obviously Penny Royal is on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Google and all the different podcast platforms. So definitely give us a follow, find us on there. If anybody wants to dig deeper into all these stories and basically as our research unfolds, definitely consider becoming a member of the Liminal Lodge, where we talk about all this stuff in real time. And pennyroyalpodcast.com. Hidden in the Herd will probably be a separate podcast, but then I might end up doing Penny Royal Presents Hidden in the Herd. I haven't decided yet, you know, but ultimately it'll be a sort of a separate project. I'll have information on all this stuff. It'll be out there on the interwebs. And also keep a lookout, shooting for March to release season 3 of Penny Roll, maybe a little bit later, but that's what I'm shooting for.
Awesome.
Spring equinox.
yeah. Which, you know, coincidentally, we have other projects ongoing at the exact same time.
Yes.
It's a good time. It's a good time to be a weirdo.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah.
Thank you again, Nathan. It's always, every time I converse with you, it reinvigorates my love for the sport.
Man. Thank you. Thanks for having me back on too, dude. I love the patio. So.
Oh, you got a special chair in the patio.
Thanks.
It's reserved all the time. Thanks.
And we're back. Man, Nathan Isaac.
Yeah. I hope you guys enjoyed that interview.
Good stuff.
Now we got Jason coming up.
I got to follow that.
My long-winded story.
Story of my paranormal career. I got to follow Nathan Isaac.
Yeah.
Shit, might as well go home.
I know. I say that every time I go on.
That's why I make you go first.
I know.
Makes myself look better.
Yeah. And, well, it gets me into the... It gets me leveled out because you're more accustomed to it by now.
I am. So, Mantell incident. This is a really, really interesting story where I suspect government cover-up.
Ooh.
And we will dig into it. It's not a an unusual story to come across, but it's something I haven't covered, and I wanted to cover it, especially having Nathan, who is synonymous with Kentucky, a good friend of the show, Matthew Bird, lives in Franklin, Kentucky now, and my tattoo guy is right across the street from Fort Knox. So.
Oh, okay. I know the tattoo shop, actually.
Scarlet Rose.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I go. Yep. Louisville. Well, west side of Louisville.
Yeah, west side of Louisville. Used to run, used to LARP back in the day, so we used to go to Fort Knox.
Event
that we held every year there.
Yeah.
And then people that were with us got caught drinking at the event, and they got everybody kicked out.
Of course.
Never holding it at Fort Knox anymore. Because it's non-alcohol grounds, you know.
Sure, yeah, sure. Yeah, go see Jason Joyce at Scarlet Rose. Anyhow, the Mantell incident. Here we go. This is from the unmuseum.org. Great article.
Ooh, unmuseum.
Yep. Or UN Museum. I think it's unmuseum.
Yeah.
Like, anyway, the F-51D Mustang came plummeting out of the sky like a sick bird. At the last second, it tried to pull out of its fatal dive, but it was too late. 9,000 pounds of steel, glass, and rubber disintegrated in the air, then slammed into the ground. The wings and tail tore off and were thrown thousands of feet from the body of the aircraft. When the smoking fuselage finally came to rest on a farm field in Franklin, Kentucky, Air Force Captain Thomas F. Mantell, a pilot with 2,867 hours of flight experience, was dead. But why did he die? The story starts several hours earlier on January 7, 1948, at about 1:45 p.m. Calls had been coming into the Godman Air Force Base in Kentucky from nearby Fort Knox about a UFO. Sergeant Quentin Blackwell, chief operator at the Godman Control Tower, had just spotted the object himself. Later, he recalled that it resembled an ice cream cone topped with red. The tower crew called the operations officer, Captain Gary Carter, and pointed the object out to him. Carter, in turn, called Colonel Guy Hicks, the commanding officer. That's at 1:45. At 2:20 p.m., a flight of four F-51D aircraft approached Godman en route from Marietta Air Force Base to Standiford Air Force Base. The flight, led by Captain Mantell, was requested by the Godman Tower to investigate the object. Mantell agreed and started climbing. Two other Mustangs went with him. The fourth, low on fuel, continued on to Standiford. At 14,000 feet, Mantell reported, "The object is directly ahead of me and above me now, moving at about half my speed." The three planes rose together, nearing 22,000 feet. Because the air is so thin at high altitudes, pilots and planes with non-pressurized cabins operating above 14,000 square feet are required to use oxygen masks. Without supplementary oxygen, a pilot can become delirious and black out. Two of the Mustangs broke off the pursuit because their oxygen tanks were low. Mantell, apparently believing he was getting enough oxygen, kept going. At around 3:15, some of the tower crew thought they heard Mantell say, "It appears to be a metallic object or possible reflections of the sun from a metallic object, and it is of tremendous size. I'm still climbing. The object is above and ahead of me, moving at my speed or faster. I'm trying to get close for a better look." Further messages from the pilot were garbled, and shortly after, all contact was lost. At 3:50 p.m., the Godman Tower lost sight of the UFO, too. At about 5 p.m., the remains of Mantell's plane were found scattered across a farm. The Air Force investigation determined that Mantell had probably lost consciousness due to lack of oxygen. When his plane hit about 25,000 feet. The aircraft may have continued to climb till it reached 30,000 feet, its limit, then nosedived. As it raced toward the ground, Mantell may have recovered his senses and tried to pull up, but it was too late. The forces of the dive were too high, and the plane came apart while still in the air. There were rumors that the plane had been shot down by a UFO, or that the Russians had caused the crash, or that the body was missing from the cockpit, or the wreckage was highly radioactive. None of that's true. But a mystery did remain. If Mantell had blacked out and crashed while he was chasing something, just what was he chasing? The Air Force suggested several explanations. First, was that the object was the planet Venus. So ridiculous, but of the time, pretty on par. And that continued on through Project Blue Book, naming anything and everything they could.
Venus. For Saturn.
Swamp gas.
Swamp gas, yeah.
While Venus is often mistaken for a UFO, it seems unlikely in this case. Another explanation was that the object was a weather balloon. Given Mantell's description, though, a typical weather balloon seems much too small. Another explanation offered by Professor Donald Menzel was that the object was an optical illusion known as a sundog. Sundogs, or parhelion, as they are also called, are the result of sunlight being reflected off of ice crystals high in the sky. They can appear as a large, bright object.
Looks like another sun.
Yeah.
We've seen one last year when we were on our way home from work, and we thought it was the sun, and we looked to the left, and we were like, you see that?
Two suns! What happened?
Now that I know the name of it, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
The ice crystals refracting off this light, causing it to make it look like it was the second sun.
Yep. This theory seems flawed, though, as the object was spotted from several different locations at different directions, and the sundog is dependent on the viewer, the ice, and the sun being in particular positions relative to one another. Years later, a more likely possibility surfaced. During that period, the Navy was running a top-secret program named Skyhook. It involved the use of very large balloons at very high altitudes to measure cosmic rays. It had been suggested that Mantell was chasing one of these balloons. Since the Skyhook balloons operated at much higher altitudes than the Mustang could obtain, Mantell could never have overtaken it. Still, it is impossible to prove for sure what Mantell saw. There were reports of a UFO later that same day over Ohio, too far for a Skyhook balloon to have drifted in such a short time. This next article is from the debrief.org, 2022.
Ooh.
Reports created from Project Blue Book interviews with numerous people who were witnesses to these events at various stages are included in our analysis. We will first identify the key witnesses who will be referenced here. The first group is composed of military personnel who were in or around the control tower at Godman Field and who observed the unknown object. Captain J.F. Dusler, Jr., the operations officer, Lieutenant Colonel E. Garrison Wood, Commanding Officer Colonel Hicks, Detachment Commander Lieutenant Paul I. Orner, Technical Sergeant Quentin A. Blackwell, he was the control tower chief operator, and Private First Class Stanley Oliver. Additional interviews included in this analysis were conducted with civilians and law enforcement personnel from the region. There is also testimony from the surviving pilots. As to what the object reportedly looked like, there is perhaps a surprising amount of consistency between the accounts of the witnesses. Captain Dusler described it as being shaped like a teardrop, round. PFC Oliver said it resembled an ice cream cone topped with red. Remember that from earlier. Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Orner described it as being shaped like a parachute, round, with some red lights on the bottom. Mantell's wingman, a pilot named Clements, described it as appearing like the reflection of sunlight on an airplane canopy. With the exception of Clements, all of the witnesses described something that was generally round at one end, coming to a point at the other. Teardrops, ice cream cones, parachutes would all fit that description.
Like a top spinning.
Yeah.
The old bell.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. I didn't think about that. As to the size of the object, there were also similarities. Dusler told investigators that it was large, at least several hundred feet in diameter. Mantell himself radioed the tower and said the object was metallic and in tremendous size. T.S. Blackwell, the control tower operator, simply described it as tremendous. Three other witnesses estimated the size to be between 250 and 300 feet. And that's pretty good size.
Like when they see the cigar-shaped ones, mm-hmm. It was gigantic.
Sure.
So this thing looked like the killer clowns from outer space.
Oh, yes, that's what it was.
Like it does when it spins before it shoots off.
It was the killer clowns, man. You know they reused those suits for Ernest Scared Stupid.
Yeah, it was from, that's where the masks came from.
Yep. The entire troll costumes. Yep.
They put all the troll stuff on them. Like, you notice it because of the one clown. If you look at the one clown's just painted, and it's like, oh, it's that one clown with the long arms.
Yep. I remember the first time I made that realization. Yeah, they're the exact same suits. The ensuing investigation revealed reports of what the investigators believed, or at least suspected, was the same object from a number of locations in two states. The close examination of all of these witness reports reveals what appears to be several instances of either typographical errors or mispronunciations of the names of towns and even roads. For example, references are made of a sighting at the same time in Kentucky over Mansville and Maysville, as well as Madisonville. So,
there's a bunch of bills there.
Well, but this all happened and people are writing down the different names for stuff. Despite the fact that two of the locations are more than 100 miles apart, all of them seem to be misunderstandings of the name Madisonville, Kentucky. But examining all of them in context leads us to believe that the most of the sighting locations and times can be identified. It's also worth noting that if this object was in fact a craft operated by extraterrestrials, they may have been guilty of PWI, piloting while intoxicated. The reports describe a long and winding path. The first report comes in at 7:20 a.m. over Edwardsville, Illinois, northeast of St. Louis, more than 200 miles away from Godman Field. The next reports offer conflicting times of either 1 p.m. or 1:10 over Elizabethtown, located south by southeast of Godman, just south of Fort Knox.
Yep.
Shortly after that, at either 1:20 or 1:30, an unnamed citizen called police reporting a cone-shaped object, again consistent with previous descriptions, over Madisonville. The witness also estimated it to be between 250 and 300 feet in size. So, yeah. By 2 p.m., the object was reported over Irvington, Kentucky, also reported as Irvine, which was likely a typo, roughly 10 miles west of Godman Field and simultaneously over Owensboro, 63 miles to the west, and Maysville, in quotes. In this portion of the Blue Book report, the sightings attributed to both Owensboro and Maysville had lines drawn through the names. That brings us to 2:30 p.m. when the object is first sighted over Godman Field at Fort Knox. Reports of when the tower last had radio contact with Mantell vary, but it seems to have been between 4:15 and 4:30 p.m. The crash of Mantell's plane in Franklin, Kentucky took place at approximately 4:45 p.m., according to civilian witnesses. That means that the plane traveled more than 90 miles to the south with a presumably unconscious or deceased pilot before performing a high-speed nosedive toward the ground, either exploding or disintegrating in midair high above the wreckage site. Meanwhile, airfields from St. Louis, Coffeyville, Kansas, Fort Smith, Arkansas, and Kansas City, Missouri, reported sightings of a great ball of light they were tracking headed west by southwest at 250 miles an hour. In April of 1948, Air Material Command at Wright-Patterson
always goes back to Wright-Pat.
Sent a request to the Flying Safety Division at Langley Air Force Base requesting a copy of the accident report on Mantell's crash. The request specifically indicated that the report would be used in an intelligence study with respect to Project Sign, which is on page 41 of the linked archive from this website. In a sad coincidence, Franklin, Kentucky was the town where Thomas Mantell was born and raised before joining the military. It was almost as if his faithful P-51 had brought him home to his final resting place. A plaque erected in his honor remains there to this day. Over the course of the Blue Book investigation, multiple letters from Air Material Command at Wright-Patt Air Force Base were sent out requesting all meteorological records from the region on the day in question. They also asked astronomers to identify the positions of both Venus and Jupiter in the sky on an hourly basis. They definitely seemed to be looking for any mundane explanation, but even their own investigation found that those planets would not be visible during daylight hours, and the weather was good for visibility. I'm telling you, man.
So it wasn't Venus.
Nope. Absolutely not. Given the specific, nearly identical descriptions of the size and shape of the object provided by multiple witnesses, the idea that everyone involved had simply misidentified a star or planet should easily be ruled out. The slow speed and size of the object have led some to suggest it may have been a blimp or perhaps even a skyhook balloon. These balloons were developed in the 40s, and the general shape could be a good fit for the teardrop shape described by witnesses. But Mantell and the other pilots drew fairly close to the object. Would they not have been able to identify a balloon? You'd think so. As for what happened to Mantell, investigators concluded that he became hypoxic after flying higher than 20,000 feet. This does not explain how pilot Clements was able to climb to 33,000 feet in the same model, P-51,
yes,
when he returned to continue the search. However, that's also well below the maximum rated altitude of the P-51 Mustang. A later report from Werner confirmed that. Clements did obtain a fresh supply of oxygen while refueling, so perhaps Mantell ran out without realizing it. Some popular documentaries on the Mantell crash seem to suggest that his plane came down shortly after encountering the object. This has led to the suggestion that it had taken some sort of offensive action against him. But as noted earlier, Mantell's plane flew more than 90 miles before crashing, presumably without a conscious pilot controlling it. Would that have happened to a plane with an unconscious or deceased pilot at the controls? A look at the flight controls of the P-51 doesn't make that entirely clear, but a view of the center stick control column in the cockpit and how the pilot's body is oriented, along with the position of the pilot's hand on the controls, offer some clues. If the pilot were to become unconscious or die, their hand would almost certainly drop off of the stick. The pilot's harness would prevent the body from leaning forward onto the stick, With no hand on it, the Mustang's center stick would spring back to the default position of orienting the plane for steady forward movement at a constant altitude. Provided the plane was oriented toward the south when Mantell was disabled, and there was sufficient fuel left in the tank, it's not difficult to see how the aircraft would have flown to Franklin, Kentucky before the engine died. Would the plane have then gone into a steep nosedive? Well, the P-51 is a very nose-heavy aircraft. There is still no smoking gun in terms of what actually happened to Thomas Mantell in the final moments when he approached the unidentified object, nor are we left with a definitive conclusion as to what the object was. It remains in the eye of the observer to debate whether this was a mundane case of a pilot running out of oxygen while investigating an escaped test balloon, or one of the few suspected dogfights between a military pilot and a potentially extraterrestrial craft where the aliens gained the upper hand.
Goes back to the EMP film.
Yeah, that too.
Nothing was chasing anything. Could have been accidental by them. I mean, can they shut it off? Would they have shut it off someone when they got that close?
I don't know. But it definitely wasn't the explanation provided by the government.
No. Like I said, the harness would have kept him from falling onto the stick.
Yep.
Leveled out. The gyro inside of it. Yep. Fly, they would have leveled out in a steady pace flying forward.
So it ran out of gas.
Yes. So it ran out. And then it would have took a nosedive.
It's really odd that he crash landed in the town where he was born and raised. Right?
Yes.
That's weird.
That's the odd part about it. Yes.
Like, what a coincidence that is.
Like they knew.
It's weird. I don't know. I've never come up with my own theory as to what really happened to Mantell. I mean, I think he probably did, you know, suffer from lack of oxygen.
Yes. Too long chasing it.
Sure.
Burn everything out.
Sure.
Tried to keep going.
But what was he following?
Yeah.
We may never know.
Pill bombs from outer spaceship.
That's it. That's the end of the episode. Like, that's it. That's the explanation. Killer clowns from outer space turned us into cotton candy. Mantell was the first victim.
First victim of the killer clowns from outer space.
Man, 1948 was a wild time.
Yeah, 1948 was wild time.
It was. So, hey, you have a theory on the Mantell incident? Hit us up. Send us a text message. Leave us a voicemail. Our number for the Paranormal Patio Hotline. 765-665-6488. We really do need to see if we can come up with, like, letters for that. Like,
yes.
That'd be cool.
Well, yeah. Put it in some AI, the last four numbers.
Yeah, there's got to be a quick way of doing that.
Yes, there has to be.
It'd be cool if we could find something weird, you know, weird related, but... Yeah, that is Transdimensional Vessels. Keith, glad that you could be back, man.
I'm glad you. That was a good episode.
And, you know, we're all looking forward, anxiously awaiting the arrival of Hidden in the Herd, as well as Pennyroyal Season 3.
Season 3, Pennyroyal.
It's going to be a great time, and I can't wait. I'm actually going to be going and visiting with Nathan in March, so maybe I'll have some details.
How many trips to Kentucky you've been making a year now?
Oh, man, I don't know. Last year wasn't as bad. I kind of did everything all at the end of the year.
Yeah.
I was gone for, like, all of November. On top of that, I went to Virginia and Point Pleasant.
Yeah.
Like, right in the middle of that. Came back, was here for a week, and then went to Nashville for 3 days with Adam Talla.
I didn't go to the festival.
I just went to Point Pleasant.
I heard the festival was kind of...
I don't know.
This year, kind of. So many people this year, like it was exploded in population, and there's
It always is bad, but I think because they had been down for 2 years because of the C word that we don't say, I think people really showed up and showed out, and I think it was probably overwhelming. The town is not big. I mean, it's a small little town.
No, it's not big. I mean, if you've ever played Fallout 76, you go right in there.
I haven't played it. Is it to scale?
Yeah, I don't know if it is, but it's a little town at the end of Point Pleasant. You go down there and you have to collect the Mothman eggs and do this little quest.
That's awesome.
That's what that whole game's about.
Yeah.
It's like the cryptids of...
Yeah. I really do want to play that. I need to play
Appalachia.
It.
The Appalachia.
Yeah.
It's not bad. It's just... It's Fallout.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not New Vegas or Fallout 4 by any means.
Right.
But it's not bad.
Yeah.
It's,
I might give it a go.
Just online only.
Right. I don't think there's probably very many people playing it right now, so
you'd be surprised. Now, once anything hits Game Pass on X,
that's fair.
Xbox Live.
Is it cross-platform?
No.
Good. Because there's no Game Pass for PlayStation.
No, you guys got that over there on PlayStation, don't you?
Oh, I like it better.
Do you?
Yeah.
I've just been Xbox since Xbox came out. Yeah. And the games I did want to play on 360 were 360, so I went to that, and then Xbox One, and then I've not gotten the new one yet.
Yeah.
I don't see that. I don't play enough to see myself getting it.
Yeah.
Not tell Pop that job to.
Sure.
If you're any Path2Exile players out there,
give us a call at the hotline.
Give us a call at the hotline, and we'll talk about Path2Exile.
Hey, and if you need us to make a tinfoil hat for you, just hit us up. Yep. Send us a text. We'll get you one.
Free will donations.
I've got this awesome winged.
Winged?
It started out as a chin strap, but it was too hot and too loud. I couldn't do it.
Yeah, the wing, it looks kind of like a World War II helmet. Now look, a winged helmet. Yeah.
You got the mohawk going on.
The mohawk hat, yeah.
We're safe, and you could be safe too. Thanks for tuning in for this wonderful episode. One of my favorites, I think, in the books here.
Yes, and how many more do we have for the season?
At least four.
Okay.
For sure. And we're definitely going to be getting into a lot of the things that I know we're both really anxious to dig into. So, a
lot more on the area. Always, one story will always be around the area we come from, even if we don't locate where we're from. I mean...
We're in the Wabash Valley.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
You know the Wabash Valley. You're from the Wabash Valley. You know both sides of this. We're technically like our own area because how we sat on the Illinois. So it's like, why don't we just make our own state right there in the middle?
We don't need to get into that.
Yeah.
We'll have people calling in with all kinds.
Right here, and we'll just block off the rest of Illinois and Indiana, and we'll start our own state from the Wabash Valley down to Ohio. It's all practically the same thing. You can go in anywhere. You talk about, I was in Illinois. You're in Illinois. I was in Indiana this week. And then you realize, Indiana's 15 minutes away.
Yeah.
In a straight line. Well, straight line-wise, but it's 20 minutes away through roads and bridges. Yep.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can also visit www.paranormalpatio.com for links to this and other episodes, as well as become a Patreon member. For just $3 a month, you'll get access to this and future episodes in video format and get them before anyone else. For your hosts, Jason and Keith, I'm your mysterious narrator, CJ Wheelwright, and this is Paranormal Patio. The Season 5 theme song is provided by Carl Casey at White Bat Audio.